Are you ready to talk about blockchain and such?
Sure.
You sure?
I think so.
Okay.
I think so.
Let me get my timer thing going.
My son is sick, so it was a long night. But
so you didn't sleep at all last night?
Yeah, not really.
How old is your son now?
He is 21 months.
I love that the podcast audience hears 21. And I know that means months right away because, of course.
First, it sounds like I forget my son's birthday. He's like, hey, 20 or 21 now?
Exactly.
Oh, months. Oh, right.
This is Geek Speak with Lyle Troxell, a show exploring the intersection of humanity and technology coming from the fringes of Silicon Valley.
So is this fully recorded or are we live streaming?
Oh, yeah, I've been recording the entire time. Okay. No, I always edit now. I never do live. Sometimes I have people on remote that listen to the show and kind of give feedback and stuff. Mm-hmm. Greg Merkley, who listens to every show pretty much live, and then titles the show for us and stuff. So we have fun titles that are like kind of representational 15 things jammed into one title.
Nice.
Kind of fun.
Yeah, when I used to do a podcast, actually it was live, and then there was my buddy would edit it. And after listening through it the whole way, he would come up with the title because we usually would meander through a variety of topics. And so
that's exactly right. So Greg kind of does that live time. So like here are some titles. John Barlow secures Verizon's Bitcoins. That was last week. Japanese teapot maps Super Mario. Amazon goes with buses after Australian meltdown.
This sounds like that AI that generated color names.
It's kind of, it's kind of like that. So you grab like the most important word out of every news story and then try to make a sentence out of it. And it's interesting, we had a complaint recently on Twitter. Someone was like, hey, this is annoying. And I get that.
That's a tweet. Hey, this is annoying.
It was more verbose and eloquent than that. Yeah. But the gist of it was, I don't like your names, your shows. And I've been doing the show for, I don't know, 17 years from that. When I was on radio before, we do the radio show live. You don't have to name a show live when it's live. It's just the show that it is. And so then I'd go and try to put it up on the podcast, and I have to come up with names. And the names of the show for the first 5 years are like Geek News. You know, it got redundant. So somebody came up with this idea of, well, just make the story, just make the title out of a collection.
Yeah.
And I thought it was fun.
That's exactly how we did it. We would do the live show, and then like, you have to come up with a title for the archive.
Yeah. And at some level, I'm hoping that if somebody's listened to the episode, and then they look at the title, they'll associate that title like, oh, I remember that show.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's true or not.
But it's nice. It's a nice fantasy.
It's a nice fantasy.
Yeah.
So, Kyle, you and I used to live near each other.
Very near.
Very near each other.
Very near.
Same property. And we met shuttling on the bus to and fro from Santa Cruz to Netflix, which is in Los Gatos.
Yeah, that was a total coincidence that we started a conversation about my wanting to live a more rural life.
I'm like, I've got the place for you.
I've got a rural life for you.
And now you've bought a house downtown Santa Cruz and are not as rural, but still in Santa Cruz.
Yes. Yeah, we're on the west side, so we're at the fringes of the suburban center that is Santa Cruz.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely if you're from a city, it doesn't feel like a suburban center.
Yeah.
But in any case, you and I both work at Netflix, and you work on kind of this deep layer that is the ability for video playback to occur. It's part of that piece.
Yes. So our feature is the play button.
The play button. After the play button is pushed, assuming that UI engineers like me do the right thing, it's all you from there.
Yes.
Yeah. And it's a JavaScript framework, right?
That's correct. And it bridges into the SDK, which is C++. And then that goes down into the device. We stop, though, have input into what happens sort of in that bridging section.
Okay. But we're not here to talk about Netflix deep guts today. We're actually here to talk about cryptocurrency, specifically the blockchain technology. And there's a lot of people here that are actually doing like Bitcoin trading or currency trading.
Yes.
And I've dabbled in it, you know, played around in that space. But you were really eloquent recently you sat down to chat with me about the other neat things that blockchains produce. And we'll get into that pretty soon.
Okay.
But I wanted to kind of give everybody a general idea of how you can think about cryptocurrency slash blockchain. So the first one of its type at all was Bitcoin. And can you explain how the blockchain works? Let's go ahead and talk about the blockchain. And they're synonymous, right? Cryptocurrencies and blockchain, they're synonymous?
No.
Okay.
No, they're not synonymous. That's a great question and probably a good place to start. So One can think about cryptocurrency as trying to invert your bank account. So if we all think of our bank accounts as buckets with money in them, and you put more money in the bucket and you take money out of the bucket, and then if you look in the bucket, you can see the level of money in the bucket. But there's another way to think about your bank account. Your bank account is actually a sequence of transactions. Mm-hmm. Add $100, remove $25, add $1,000, remove $1,000. And if you just walk through the transactions, you will arrive at the same amount mm-hmm. as if it were a bucket. And so you don't really need the bucket. You just need the list of changes, essentially.
Isn't this what banks are doing anyway when they're talking about a checking account? I mean, there's not some physical location that has my stuff. And there's probably a summed row that represents the number that's currently there with pending transactions. But there's a lot of automatic results that are occurring all the time to come up with the figure that actually is in my checking account.
Right. And there's some shorthand. I mean, they keep close at hand what your available balance is, and then they know that they have some pending transactions that haven't been applied to that to your actual balance, and so your available is sort of an estimate of mm-hmm. what they think will resolve out of those transactions.
Right. But of course, they might not even know about a check that I wrote to somebody that they haven't brought in yet. But for me, my value looks different in my mind or in my local registry because, of course, there's this pending transaction that will hit the bank, hopefully, if the person cashes my check.
Yeah, and that's a great extension on the analogy, and kind of where I was going is that your bank account is also very asynchronous, unlike a bucket, which is how it's presented to you. So the analogy that people have is that the bank knows what's in the bucket, but they actually don't, because you could have outstanding checks. You could have just run a credit transaction that hasn't actually hit the clearinghouse system yet, but the credit card company knows, and you know, and GameStop knows, or wherever you spent the money. So there's a distributed element to the knowledge of the balance of your bank account.
Right.
And blockchain, or rather the sort of digital money or digital cash as the underlying abstraction behind Bitcoin, is to just make that explicit, that everything is just a sequence of transactions, and the only thing left to do is figure out how we all agree what the right sequence is. Today, the arbitrator is your bank. They actually choose the order in which these things hit your balance. And there was that scandal several years ago about how they'll reorder it to maximize overdraft fees. Like, they have some incentive in what the order is.
Right.
Whereas a system like Bitcoin, by trying to sort of break open that bucket abstraction and say, no, it's just a list of transactions. And if we all agree on the order, we all know what the bottom line is.
Okay, let me poke at that a little bit.
Sure.
If I write a check to you, Kyle, mm-hmm. For the awesome night we had last night.
Yes.
Not that really happened. And you haven't submitted it to the bank. Mm-hmm. Their truth of how much I have in the account doesn't include that unknown transaction that
right.
they don't know about, right? And then I write maybe another check to somebody else, even though in reality, the amount of money the bank thinks I have is less than those two checks, hence the overdrawn problem.
Mm-hmm.
So these there emerge in the system that we currently use problems like overdraft, which of course the bank offers you a service called overdraft protection, which
yes.
they charge you even more if you do that mistake. But there is this idea that even though it seems safer in some sense to say there is a bucket of money that Lyle has, we already work in a world that's not really truth, and we have to be careful about how we manage it. So there's problems in the space.
Yeah. And this is sort of generally referred to as the double spend problem.
Yeah.
So if it looks like a bucket, but you can treat it like a virtual bucket, and as you described, it is like a virtual bucket, where if you write me a check and I call your bank and say, does Lyle have the balance to cover this check? They will say yes. And then you immediately write a check to someone else, they call the bank and say, does Lyle have the balance to cover this check? The bank will still say yes.
Right.
You have, in a sense, double spent, because I've given you goods in exchange for that check, and so has the other person. The blockchain attempts to solve this problem by making public every transaction that you have actually done.
Okay. So now, so the blockchain very clearly never has some like figure of how much money. It's always about the history of everything that's ever happened into that account.
Yes.
Okay.
And we're blending the concepts here, because a blockchain is really a kind of cryptographic construct
okay.
that ties a transaction to the prior transaction. So let's say I want to put some data on the blockchain. And to do that, I generate a hash.
Before we get into that, let's go even earlier about what the quote blockchain is. Because people talk about it, and if you don't understand what, like even structurally, does it have a location? Is it part of the cloud? Is it on somebody's computer? Is it a metaphor? Can you start from like...
It's all parts of speech.
It's
a verb, it's an adjective, it's an adverb.
And we're done. Everything we're talking about is part of speech. We're done.
So, the F word and blockchain.
So one way of thinking... let's talk about what a block actually is. Just start from the beginning.
Okay.
Because a blockchain...
That's what I was getting
to. Good. Okay.
But you're right. Let's start with... what is it? So it's data. And in fact, the common analogy is that it's a database. So all systems have databases. Even the bank that we're talking about has a database that processes transactions and then has some state of all your accounts and your username and password, or the hopefully not your password in the clear, but something like your password.
And for people that haven't dealt with databases, an Excel spreadsheet is like a very simple database.
Yeah. Some people have worked with like Microsoft Access. And, yeah. I mean, there's a bunch of light databases that you can use. And it's really just to store information about the world that you want to access later. And, you know, you want to keep records that will survive your computer restarting, essentially.
Okay. Cool.
So a blockchain is a database of which there can be copies on many, many computers. And they're... It goes sort of hand in hand with a reconciliation process where my version of the database and Lyle's version of the database can be reconciled. Where if somehow we're out of sync, or I have transactions that Lyle doesn't, or vice versa, we have a process to get us on the same page so that after the process completes, we will have exact replicas of each other's database. And this can happen for an arbitrary number of people. So you can have copies on many, many computers throughout the world, and the process can handle that. So no matter who you are and what copy of someone else's database you have seen, both parties can come to agreement on what the right state is, and then they will put their database in that state.
Okay. And when we talk about like Bitcoin, the most famous of these types of databases, what we're talking about is one database instance which multiple people have copies of, and there's a whole mathematical process for making sure this reconciliation is the same across everywhere.
Yes.
And this database is made up of multiple blocks that are chained together, and that's why it's called a blockchain. So it's a data structure shared by lots of people that are made up of these blocks, and the process of building the blocks ensures its integrity somehow. Okay.
Yes.
Let's go ahead and describe a transaction then on the system.
Actually, I'm going to be a little bit more abstract than that, because I read a great description of this, which hopefully for non-technical people, this will give you an intuition of what a blockchain would look like if you had a picture of it.
Okay.
So a block is like taking a selfie. And to get to the next block, you have to take a selfie holding up a picture of the prior selfie. And then you take another picture of yourself...
With the embedded picture. Which is kind of like the whole that's a proof that the second one was taken after the first one.
Yes.
Right? Because you couldn't have taken that picture without the first one being taken.
Right. And if I see one that's, say, 4 pictures deep and you have one that's 5 pictures deep, I have to assume yours is more recent than mine.
And in that also, that's kind of interesting, for us to have created the fourth picture, we somewhere had to have the first picture, even though in the fourth picture, that first picture is not very important. It was only used to kind of assure the second and third. Like that's the purpose of having the picture of the picture of the picture. I like that metaphor quite a bit.
Yeah. So that we can actually find the point at which we diverged. Because at some level of depth in these pictures, we'll find the point at which, now we have a common history.
Uh-huh.
So I have pictures 1 through 6. And so do you, but then my 7, 8, 9 are different from your 7, 8, 9.
Right.
And in fact, yours is 10 or 12 or 15.
So let's say picture 6 was me smiling with my selfie. Mm-hmm. And I took a picture. That's the picture 6. And my picture 7, I'm standing at the boardwalk someplace, mm-hmm. and I have that picture, and I'm taking a picture with me frowning, but my picture of me smiling is in the picture. Yeah. And then you also take a photograph in Pennsylvania of me smiling, that first, that mm-hmm. number six photo, and but you're in Pennsylvania, and you take a picture. And now if we keep on building off that, there's a problem because we've diverged, but we can tell we've diverged.
Yeah, and so some third person has basically both of our pictures, and they see several pictures deep, and then they see me in Pennsylvania, and they see you at the boardwalk, and now they have two versions of history mm-hmm. That they have to reconcile, and right. that's the process part that I referred to.
Now, of course, we're not taking photographs.
Right.
We're using cryptography to sign these things, to hash and sign these things.
Sort of. So the signature is within the transactions. The blocks. There's a type of math function called a hash function that can take in sort of arbitrary size data and sort of digest it down to a fixed size nonsense chunk of data. But that nonsense chunk of data is, for all intents and purposes, unique amongst all arbitrarily
sized. That's the selfie.
So that's the selfie.
Okay.
And that, if you think of that in sort of a physical metaphor, it's sort of like a little dangling hook on the end of the block. So the block is self-contained. And there's this little dangling hook that is unique to that block on which I'm going to hang the next block.
Okay.
And that's the taking the picture.
Link.
Yeah.
Okay.
So that's the taking the picture of myself. Within that block, if you think of it as sort of a hollow object, inside are the transactions. The transactions also have this feature that every transaction is self-contained and has a little hook on which you hang the next transaction. So there's a thread that goes ostensibly unbroken through all the transactions out of the block into the next block through all those transactions, et cetera. So it's like a single filament that you can trace all the way back to the beginning.
And that filament is mathematically true, is what it is.
Right.
Conceptually, that's what we're trying to talk about.
Yeah. So that's the point, is that you generate something that can't be forged. That's sort of like an identifier or the picture, the selfie, and then you embed that as part of the next transaction, and then within the block or at the block level, you do it with the next block. So you have one unbroken chain that you can follow backwards in time until you find where, you know, you took the picture on the boardwalk and I took the picture in Pennsylvania. But before that, we can follow the chain all the way back to the very first selfie.
Okay. I don't know how much we want to get into the cryptography part of it because it does get pretty challenging. Mm-hmm. But suffice it to say, the neat thing about this is that every single one of those transactions I can get and reconfirm if I want with a computer.
Right.
And you can get them and reconfirm them.
Yes.
And this is how we come up with I don't have to trust you and you don't have to trust me if we can look at all these transactions and go, yep, that looks good, confirming that thread.
Yeah, so that's one of the other principles that's in the original paper describing Bitcoin, is that one of the strengths is that I don't have to confer with you or anybody else. I can draw my own conclusions, and all honest participants would draw the same conclusion. I have no special information about the transactions of the blockchain or pending transactions that, you know, it'd really be more convenient for me if we reordered it this way, because I know that you may not have the same incentive, so I have to order it as I think you would order it.
Okay. For us to have the same agreed upon truth.
Yeah.
Now, so this kind of database is very different than the bank's database. Because in the bank's database perspective, they're just the source of truth. And every decision that the bank makes is true.
They also authorize transactions on your behalf. So you mentioned signing earlier, and that's where that kind of plays in, also with the bank analogy.
Okay.
The bank has to sign off on transferring the money, right? Because they have all the money.
Right.
And if somebody attempts to take money out of your account without their authorization, then there's, you know, legal ways for them to go after that person or get the money back, or they can just deny the transaction. Mm-hmm. Anybody who's had a debit card declined, I mean, that's the bank saying, maybe you have some of that money, or maybe you don't, or maybe I don't want to give it to you, or maybe the internet's right. down.
Or maybe you just bought 15 pairs of shoes and 7 tanks of gas in Nebraska, and you're trying to buy something in California. Something's wrong. Let's turn it off.
So the bank's fraud detection algorithm actually makes some decisions for you about when you can or can't authorize moving money from one account to another. That's where the signing element comes in.
Right.
So at the transaction level, each individual has signing authority. And so that's sort of the other key thing.
Instead of the bank having it.
Right. So when you sort of crack open that bank account analogy, somebody has to be able to authorize, and that falls on the individual.
And so in the bank situation, when I write you a check, I sign my name. Theoretically, the bank has my name, my signature on file. When you submit my check to them, they go, oh, look, this check is printed the same way that Lyle normally prints checks. It's got numbers that haven't been submitted to this form. Mm-hmm. It has a scribble of penmanship that looks like what we have on file for Lyle, assuming that they even check that, which I don't think they do. And then they say, we've decided to approve this transaction, to log this transaction. At any point during that time, they didn't have to do it. So even if we think that my check assigning authority is actually me modifying my money, it's not. It's me asking the bank to modify the money, and then they can decide to trust that or not.
Right.
So they're still the signing authority from that perspective.
Yes. So they are a gatekeeper in that way. So you are authorizing the bank to authorize my bank to take money from you.
Right. Right. Okay. So let's talk. I guess it'd be behoove us to talk about the wallet concept in this blockchain thing.
Sure. We haven't actually hit the coin part.
Oh, okay. Let's talk about the coin part.
Of the Bitcoin.
That's good. That's a good point.
Yeah. So there's this whole analogy about cracking open the bank account and that it's really just a ledger to which you can only add records that depend on all prior records. So that, and there's a reconciliation process where we can figure out whose ledger is correct. And there's the process for that. Everybody is incentivized to follow because you should assume that everyone else who's following it will... You know, in that way, you'll get to a consistent end state where we all know how much money everybody has. We haven't introduced money. So,
how much Bitcoin?
So what's the original inputs? Like, how do you get money into this system? Because there is, at bottom, a selfie. There's the first selfie that somehow puts all the money in the system.
Yeah.
So, Bitcoin actually has a progressive minting process that creates new coins. And this is defined in the protocol. So one of the things that I think maybe gets skipped over when people are thinking about Bitcoin is that it's just a defined set of rules. It's the process for how money or how coins get created and how we reconcile when we have a disagreement. So we have this common data structure, the blockchain, and there's some rules about it, like what math functions to use for certain operations so that, again, we can agree independently. If we just use the prescribed math function and the prescribed data, we'll arrive at the same answer. Mm-hmm. And then we both independently can decide how to reconcile if we follow the reconciliation rules. And we can validate that all of the coins in the system were only created by the process that creates coins.
Right.
But again, this is just a protocol that an engineer came up with. And this is why there are many...
Well, an unknown person came up with.
Right. An unknown person or persons or AI or whatever the conspiracy theory of the day is. And this is why there are many cryptocurrencies, because the protocol is human-defined. We define how we want to create new coins and how we want to reconcile and how we want to transfer value, et cetera, et cetera.
Is this, can you think of this protocol, for people that don't talk about what protocols all are, can you kind of think about it as
rules.
Like a contract or rules?
Yeah, it's a set of rules. And so the rules of Bitcoin to create new Bitcoins are to a valid block of transactions has the format that it uses that prior selfie, and the first transaction in the sequence that relies on that selfie is special in that the protocol is paying the person who submits that transaction. This is what Bitcoin mining is.
So Bitcoin mining is creating the first entry, the first record of a new block.
Right. So if you and I are both trying to create a block, my first transaction will be different from yours because my first transaction is pay Kyle and your first transaction will say pay Lyle.
And
our names are awfully similar.
Yeah,
let's say my name was Michael. The first transaction for me would be pay Michael and yours would be pay Lyle. And then from there, they may look exactly the same. All of the other transactions that hinge off of that first pay myself transaction will still be well-formed and we'll end up with the same thing.
This is the equivalent to you taking a picture in Pennsylvania and me taking a picture at the boardwalk.
Right. And
it's kind of like who does it first kind of wins.
Yeah, more or less. So who gets their picture circulated to the most people who then say, yeah, that's correct. That picture has the pictures I expect sort of embedded within it. So I'm going to take a picture with the Kyle selfie in Pennsylvania, and now that has been confirmed. So that the terminology is that's a confirmation.
Okay.
So someone else has validated that my selfie with all the prior selfies matches the pattern they expect, and so they take a selfie with it, which is an implicit approval of the thing that I did.
And they're doing that transaction to make a payment or do something with it. Like they want to go ahead and pay for some pizza, and so they grab your selfie picture with the blockchain behind it, and they take a new picture saying I'm paying for this pizza, which is their transaction. And that's kind of like what we're talking about. Every transaction is kind of a movement of Bitcoin currency.
So what you're describing is creating a block. So the blocks are the selfies.
Okay, sorry.
Transactions are more like checks. So you want to write me a check, but you don't just send it to me. You send it to the network and say, I'm writing Kyle a check for 100 Bitcoins, and then I write a check and submit it to the network, and I want to pay Michael 500 Bitcoins.
All the transactions, then, like in your checking account.
Right.
That kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. And then the selfies are the things that sort of gather up. So in the selfie, imagine that including the selfie of the or the prior selfie, there's also all of the checks that have been written.
Yeah.
So you can look at all the checks that have been written, look at all the prior selfies and say, yep, that matches what I expect. So now I'm going to take a selfie with a bunch of checks that I want sort of made permanent and then submit that.
You're listening to GeekSpeak. I'm Lyle Troxell. I'm speaking with Kyle Barr. We are talking about cryptocurrencies and blockchains, and we're actually going to get into the more interesting changes that can occur because of this new types of structures. But he introduced this wonderful idea of the blockchains being defined, the blocks being defined by take a selfie of a selfie and keep on doing that. So over time, you've built a long history that everybody can agree is the same truth. So Kyle, thank you so much for being here.
Hey, you're welcome.
Chatting with us about this. What's the coin then? What is the actual coin?
So the coin, this is this question comes up a lot.
It's because people talk about it as it's a real thing, and of course it's not.
It's really, it's what I described. It's an entry in the ledger that has no source. So when you write me a check, it's you're the source and I'm the recipient. The protocol that says here's how you create a block that everyone else who's following the protocol will accept. And then your responsibility is to accept well-formed blocks. Well-formed blocks start with a transaction with no source, just a recipient.
Which is the mining.
That's the mining. And it's mining, it's minting new coins. There's a lot of analogies that people use.
Yeah.
Mining is sort of refers to the fact that it's a discovery process and it takes time, which is why lots of people dedicate lots of computer resources to it.
So let me ask you real quick.
Sure.
Little mining, minting, first blockchain entry thing is a mathematical – it's a number signing other things that has unique quality that the protocol defines.
Sort of. So it's actually the – let me think of how to describe this. So a block, if you imagine a block, again, it's sort of a hollow structure that you put a bunch of transactions in. It
like an envelope.
Like an envelope, but it's an envelope missing a piece. And it's missing a piece of kind of a random shape. And the first person to find the right random shape that completes the envelope has a valid envelope.
Okay.
And everyone else can see immediately or with very little effort that it's a valid envelope as opposed to an incomplete envelope.
Okay. That's great. So it's a jigsaw puzzle that's
yes.
mathematically proven based off of all the other entries in that block.
Yes.
Okay. So this thing that you have to create actually closes the last block.
Yes.
Okay.
So yeah. So it's the missing piece of the envelope, and then once you do that, you've created a complete envelope
okay.
that you then sort of send out to.
And you can kind of think of this as like everybody's producing all these different things, and they're all a whole bunch of transactions. All this like a checking account, a whole bunch of different things.
Yep.
And there's one algorithm that you can produce across these things that will come up with a number. If you add some other number to that, you're going to get a different number. And what's basically happening is you're looking for the output number of all the things that are in there, plus this especially when you're going to add, you're looking for that output number to be of defined by the protocol. I think it's a leading zeros or trailing zeros.
That's correct. So we can get that specific, but this is part of how the protocol protects itself from somebody just basically renting the entirety of Amazon Cloud to do this. There's a nice property of producing a very large number at the end that you can define some characteristics about the number that are very easy to check and very difficult to produce.
Right.
So because you're getting a random number, you may have to try many random numbers. And if you say that the difficulty is that the first 200 digits have to be zero, that's very easy to check. But if you're just getting numbers at random, it takes a long time to get a random number that matches that shape. Now, all the numbers after those 200 zeros don't matter. And in fact, they're not checked, which is why your envelope and my envelope can be different. There are lots of solutions to that problem. In fact, there are a great number of solutions, but it's really about who stumbles upon one of them first.
Right. And stumbling upon them means checking lots of numbers.
Yes.
Okay. So we've talked quite a bit on this program and such about, you know, making sure that you use secure connections on the internet, SSL, HTTPS. And the bank always says that. And Chrome's putting new checks in to make sure to warn people when they're not using this.
Okay.
That process in place is using private key, public key signing. We won't get into that. But one of the things we always say is this cryptography, this mathematical is so good that if you had all the computers running forever, it would take till the end of the universe to find the number because it's such a the hard scope is so big.
Yes.
The Bitcoin signing of blocks or the checking of blocks, the minting, the final closure puzzle piece is defined to be easier than that, but in similar idea that it's very hard.
So it's defined to be not necessarily easier than that. In fact, this is also built into the protocol is a decaying rate of new coin creation.
Every block actually potentially would get harder and harder to create this number.
So there are two things going on. So one is that over time, there is a – gosh, I'm speaking a little out of turn here. Again, because the protocols vary based on the blockchain, but there are a couple ways to go about it. There are several blockchains that do this explicitly through difficulty by ramping up the difficulty to where you could guess random numbers from now until the end of time and you would never get one that's valid. The Bitcoin system just decays the rate at which you can pay yourself over time. And eventually that will trail off to zero and whatever, you know, Y2K, meaning, something bad will happen.
Meaning no new coins would be generated. The blank ledgers wouldn't get created.
Right. So that first transaction of pay myself, you know, right now I think it's 12 and then it will be 6 and then 3 and then 1.5 and then it decays at some rate.
Every time you find that special puzzle piece, you get some kind of ownership of 12 coins.
Yes.
Okay. So that's where the coins come from.
Yeah. So that's where the coins come from. Now, the difficulty scaling thing that I mentioned about, you know, why don't you just get, you know, rent out all of Amazon to do this is the protocol defines that it should take about 10 minutes to find the random puzzle piece. And the way that that's achieved is that there are timestamps on when these blocks get created. And me as an individual, I can look at the last 2 weeks worth of blocks, calculate the average time, and then make a difficulty adjustment of what I will accept as the new difficulty to guess that the next blocks will take 10 minutes.
And this is how it scales over time. So this is why basically every 10 minutes a new block is made in the Bitcoin chain.
Yeah.
And it doesn't matter how much computer power we put into it, it's still going to do that because everybody agrees that based off of the last 15 or so blocks and how fast they took, this is the difficulty we set.
Yeah, so if the difficulty is 10.
Auto-scaling difficulty.
Yeah, exactly. And again, because this is all individuals making the decision, there's an incentive to play honestly because if you submit your block to other honest parties, they will reject it if you try and cheat the difficulty. Mm-hmm. So I actually had this conversation over Christmas with my dad about how you can do sort of a game theoretic optimization on this. Like, could you sneak in one more block at a lower difficulty and pay yourself rather than do what you know most people are going to do, which is only accept a higher difficulty. And you can, but that you're sort of gambling that everybody else hasn't noticed yet. Mm-hmm. The difficulty actually needs to be 20, where before it was 17. You know, could I submit an 18? How many people would accept an 18?
Okay. I think we've gone enough about Bitcoin.
Sure.
Describing that. And obviously, the more computer power you get, the easier it will be for you to get that number and get paid.
Yes.
And the more people do that, the more difficulty rises. And so effectively what happens is there's a race to produce as many guesses as possible.
Right.
And the people that win that race make a lot of this coin,
yes,
which we're saying has value. This is the basic fundamental question that people keep asking me. Mm-hmm. Why does it have value? And I say it has value because it's scarce. Is that valid? It's agreed upon. It's why is the...
I was going to say, you can create a lot of things in the digital world that are scarce. CryptoKitties are scarce. I don't know how many of your listeners...
What's a CryptoKitty?
Oh, okay. So this made some tech news for a while. On one of the other blockchains, somebody produced an app that was essentially a genetic algorithm that, where they would give you a long string of numbers that represented the genetic code of a kitten. And you owned, quote-unquote, this kitten, and they had a website that would interpret that genetic code and give your kitten certain visual characteristics on their UI. And you could take two of these numbers or kittens and breed them. And then they would run some code that did essentially a genetic mix of those two kittens and produce a new-looking kitten or a new
derived
number.
From the first two.
Yeah, and because it's on the blockchain, you can trace lineage, you know, all the way back to, you know, the original kitten.
So there's other things people are doing with this other than currency.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, exactly. So
so each one of those kitties is completely unique.
Yeah, each one is completely unique because it's a very long number, so it's very unlikely you get two identical matches. And there are websites that track how common certain traits are, meaning certain subsequences. I mean, they can look almost like like allele level for people who know what that is. You know, subsets of the genetic sequence and what traits those typically map to. Some of them are unexpressed, so some traits can skip generations. I mean, it's very neat.
Recessive versus dominant, things like that.
Yeah, exactly. And so if you have a good eye or you can spot patterns, you know, you can get very valuable breeding kitties, et cetera. So this was a phenomenon for a couple of weeks where people were paying thousands of dollars worth of this other coin, Ethereum or Ether, for certain kitties. Sort of in a tulip bulb craze. Like, there's just this assumption that,
right,
you know, people would keep paying.
Okay. We've touched a little bit on the fun side of space.
Oh, right. Scarcity. Sorry. So creating scarcity. It's actually very easy to create scarcity because you can just generate a random number that nobody else will ever get. And there's only one, so that should be worth infinity. But that's not really what's going on with Bitcoin. I've read several compelling reasons why Bitcoin should or could have value. One, as you alluded to, people throw lots of compute power at it, which means lots of electricity. There's actually a physical resource constraint on how much Bitcoin can be created and who gets it. And so in addition to the protocol defining a certain number that will ever be created, some Bitcoins, you know, all Bitcoins are equal, but some are more equal than others. More recent Bitcoins took more power to produce than old Bitcoins. Mm-hmm. So that's one tie back into the physical world that that one could make the argument it cost $5,000 worth of electricity to produce a Bitcoin, so that should be in air quotes worth more than $5,000. Whether it is or isn't is sort of up to the market. There are lots of cryptocurrency exchanges that act just like the stock market or Forex.
Yeah.
But the more compelling argument to me about just the concept of these distributed ledger technologies is that they're international and completely portable, and you control your account wherever you go.
Right.
So people can move internationally. There are Bitcoin ATMs in many parts of the world now. Some, in fact, it's disrupted or supplanted national currencies in a couple of cases. Venezuela's had some crackdowns because people were mining Bitcoin or Ether with government-subsidized power. Because it was more valuable or even more stable than their local currency. Again, you can leave the country and still have control, full control of your assets. There's right. No problem of your bank just refusing to wire you money.
This is that libertarian aspect that it's crazy attractive because you control your stuff.
Yeah, and it's a lot lighter than gold.
Yeah, it doesn't have any weight at all.
Right.
It's just numbers. Okay, so I kind of understand why Bitcoin is consuming lots of power. We keep on talking about mm-hmm. Just a race to get as much because it has value and you create it by using energy, by using electricity. We're
right.
At the point where it's kind of horrible at this point. We're wasting a lot of energy doing this.
Yes.
So is that inherent in all of our cryptocurrencies or all the blockchain stuff, or is it not?
No, so that's not intrinsic. So as I mentioned, this is a particular protocol, and it was designed back in 2009 or 2008, I think is when the paper was released. And there was some assumption that you needed about 10 minutes for the whole network globally to have all the data at hand and make the reconciliation decision. So that 10 minutes is not empirical. That was just sort of a guess. More recent blockchain projects have tried to play with that number. They've set up global networks because that's very easy to do now. We have very easy access to AWS or other cloud providers that have local compute in a variety of places around the world. You can run tests. And that number varies from experiment to experiment. Sometimes it's 4 seconds, sometimes 20 seconds. So that time could come way down, for one.
Would that help on the complexity issue?
Not necessarily. There's the other part, which is the algorithm. The algorithm that decides how to close the envelope. There are several competing... Let me see how to go about this. So as I described, the principle behind closing the envelope is called proof of work. You need to generate... a proof of work is sort of an asymmetric task, one that is difficult to do but easy to verify.
We talked about that earlier, right?
Yeah.
The holders leading zeros, I can check, but for me to get the right puzzle piece that actually produced that is very hard.
Yes.
Okay.
There are lots of proof of work systems that use a variety of algorithms to be more or less difficult, depending on how much of their currency they want to generate. So if there is some... If there's an incentive, which there is on some of these blockchains, to just produce a lot of blocks very quickly, and there's not a ton of reward for creating the blocks, so either very few coins, the coins aren't very valuable, there's actually not much incentive to make it difficult. There just has to be enough time for the network to reach consensus mm-hmm. or have a reconciliation process. So one of the things that we sort of touched on but didn't really allude to how it gets resolved is... If we have two of these sort of selfie chains that have forked at some point, where...
The you in Pennsylvania, me at the boardwalk one.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So the reconciliation process in Bitcoin is you look at which picture has a longer history, and that's the winner. And the other one is discarded. All of those transactions are invalidated. Essentially, those checks get voided. Mm-hmm. It's sort of a winner-take-all scenario mm-hmm. where if you're working on the loser, it behooves you to immediately stop because no one will recognize your work. So you have been spending electricity and compute power and really get nothing for it. Other blockchains don't necessarily do that. Some of them give credit for work that was done on they're called uncle chains, where there's clearly a common history. You are acting in good faith, so we will partially... credit you for the work that's been done, things like that. So in the proof of work domain, the amount of power that's consumed is sort of directly proportional to how many people are participating. And if the protocol defines this kind of adversarial mm-hmm. winner-take-all relationship, and the value of the coin matters a lot. So it's made the news, the crypto world news, several times that other coins that use a very similar structure to Bitcoin have approached a point where it is more profitable to use your electricity to do those than to do Bitcoin. And the fear is that Bitcoin grinds to a halt because 90% of the compute power leaves, but the difficulty remains very high for 2 weeks because that's the checkpoint. And so you see, it took 2 weeks and we generated zero blocks, and then it corrects and suddenly the network starts moving again. But in the meantime, this other chain may have achieved enough momentum that Bitcoin would never be able to entice them back.
Okay. So that's a danger with Bitcoin itself.
Yeah. So you asked if this problem is inherent to blockchains. And I guess what I'm getting at is it's inherent to how much value people put on the coins, because that's where, in particular, places where there's either cheap power or government subsidized power is where we find consolidation of these large pools of compute resources dedicated to the problem.
Right.
Because they have a competitive advantage on the physical resource, electricity, that competitors won't have.
Right.
So it costs them less to mint the same number of Bitcoins.
Okay. If let's assume, so there's another blockchain that's become relatively popular. It's called Ethereum.
Yes.
It has a different protocol than Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. And it has some concepts of compute inside it. Right? Rather than just being a database, it's actually possible to create contracts and code, kind of.
Yes.
And I want to get into that. But if Bitcoin went away completely and Ethereum became kind of the dominant one, would Ethereum start using the same kind of power consumption on the planet?
At the moment, it would. So this is an area that is being actively worked on many systems. And it's a change in the mechanism to close the envelope. Mm-hmm. So the current one is proof of work. You find the random jigsaw puzzle, very easy to validate, very hard to find the random one.
And whoever finds the first one gets paid.
Yes. To a scheme that is called proof of stake. This is currently unsolved problem. It's unsolved for many blockchains. There are some projects that have something that looks like it, but it's essentially sort of turning the proof of work problem sideways. So if you imagine that every unit of computer power that you want to throw at proof of work constitutes a vote or a lottery ticket, and you are therefore proportionally to the number of lottery tickets you hold, that's how likely you are to win the block race.
Right now, the amount of lottery tickets you have is the amount of electricity you can throw at the problem.
Pretty much.
Okay, and computer power.
That's the analogy. If you can sort of convert how much computer power and electricity you use into lottery tickets, then you're that's your proportion of winning. So a proof of stake system, it tries to change the electricity for coins. So the number of coins that you invest into creating new coins is the number of votes you get or the number of lottery tickets you get. And then it's much easier to decide sort of proportionally, okay, you're going to get 40% of the things because you have 40% of the coin staked, et cetera.
So this is the kind of where research is right now in this space.
Yeah. And so this decouples us from the power constraint. The reason that it's very, very difficult, which if any of your listeners have kind of a hacker mindset, is that suddenly you're decoupled from any physical constraints to try and cheat. So in the Bitcoin world, it's very difficult to cheat because you have a physical resource that you need to expend to try and win honestly. And anything that you take away from that to try and cheat, someone else who's playing honestly will outcompete you. Once you shift to sort of entirely the virtual world where you're just dealing with sort of electronic votes and things that are passive, you've now freed up your physical resources to try and cheat. So those are the challenges that are being faced now in developing these protocols that sort of take away the constraint of electricity.
Hmm. Okay. You've described it as a database. It's a shared ledger. The more shared it is, the more reliable it is. We won't get into the details that there's actually some threat to branching of a blockchain, and actually, we won't get into that because it's interesting. But I want to get on to. We only have like another 10 minutes or so of the show for radio purposes.
It's really easy to rat hole on these things.
What is exciting to you about what can be done in the blockchain? Like what's interesting about this database that's different?
We probably need more than 10 minutes for that. So you started to go down the path of Ethereum, which is a blockchain that not only records data, but can record the execution of code. Without getting into the details of how that's done.
It's kind of like you submit an escrow document, right? Like a legal contract saying trade will happen of Bitcoin. Isn't that kind of what it is?
And they call them smart contracts. So in theory, you have written in code what you want to be executed automatically when certain conditions are met. And some of the selling points are that it becomes totally unambiguous or at least public. And in theory, you could simulate it on like a test net or a test network, you know, before actually deploying the contract live. Of course, there are security problems with that and various other issues that people have discovered or things that haven't been thought of. That's fairly exciting, though it's a little bit like a disruptor to the cloud networks. Because in theory, we're all the cloud now is sort of the pitch. Everybody who's running a server that will service this blockchain also agrees to run this code. So in that case, you may get rewarded for it, but you're really just taking part in sort of disrupting Amazon. The things that are exciting to me about blockchain, it's really unrealized at the moment, but some of the big ones, which, like I said, are compelling, are the fact that it is a portable notion of value, or maybe even just tokens, or just some representation that can move internationally very, very quickly. It can cut out systems that either create friction or make people's lives harder, or have some incentive to add a layer of rules on top.
Can we go to Ticketmaster as an example?
Sure.
Is that a good one to talk about?
That's
kind of exciting?
That's a good one. So, okay. So what I was getting at, thanks. I tend to be long-winded. So that's great. So the general term for this is disintermediation. So systems that have, whose only purpose is to try and facilitate or broker transactions between parties that don't know each other, don't trust each other, and have no prior relationship. Ticketmaster is a good example because they were sued over charging convenience fees, and really all they do is hold a monopoly on selling tickets from venues around the country.
Right.
So they have established relationships with a bunch of venues, and people want to buy tickets to shows occasionally from those venues, but not enough to open an account, and the venue doesn't want to do account management and figure out who's who and do I need a mailing list.
And there's security issues there. There's problems that emerge, right?
Right, right.
Like if a venue is showing, one week they're showing some rock concert, and another week they're doing a deaf poetry jam thing, then the audiences are completely different. The venue doesn't really want to attach themselves to those audiences. There's lots of reasons to have a middleman at some level.
Yeah. Yeah, they. It's just not in their best interest to try and reinvent or figure that stuff out. I mean, they almost want to be like a storage facility that opens up and stores some stuff for a while. In this case, an audience and a band or a poet, and then they leave, and then whatever.
Yeah.
You get new tenants. So Ticketmaster has tried to fill this niche, but once they've filled it, they have an incentive to, one, sort of be anti-competitive to anyone else who wants to do it, to dissuade or discourage venues from either going out on their own or trying to sort of terminate their relationship with Ticketmaster. And so they offer things like they'll cap the number of tickets you can buy, they charge convenience fees. Like, they're sort of free to manage their relationship with the concert goer and their relationship with the venue, when really the concert goer and the venue are the ones that matter. You
right.
go to the venue, you could pick up your tickets there, you could buy them there. So a thing like a blockchain, which is built on this notion that it's parties that don't know each other, don't trust each other, but can reach consensus on how many tickets you have, how much you paid for them, what seats you get for sort of arbitrary events, this would be an example where you could just pull Ticketmaster out of the system. If you had venues that could opt into this. And it could be side-by-side with something like Ticketmaster.
So in this situation, you would create a protocol that was a blockchain concept that was specifically designed around people purchasing tickets for venues. And you'd have to think about this pretty hard, because how do you deal with scalping? There's all these problems that emerge in that space.
Right.
But once you kind of declare the protocol and it seemed to work really well, people could leave Ticketmaster and join this thing, and effectively there wouldn't be a middleman anymore.
Yeah. So there's – this actually gets a little bit back to your power consumption thing, is that these things can be bespoke. I mean, it could be for sort of special purpose to venues. Venues actually have no incentive to make it hard or consume electricity or whatever to mint poetry jam coin.
Right.
Or whatever they want to call it for the venue. And they can generate any number equal to the number of tickets, and then people can buy them. You said that you have to handle the scalping problem. Maybe you don't. Maybe users or concert goers can submit a transaction to the blockchain saying, I got the whatever seat token from the venue, and I just want to transfer it to so-and-so, and he meets me in person and gives me cash. And it brings systems like that back to the constituent parts that really matter.
What's the problem with the federated Ticketmaster? What really is – it's because their incentive is different than the two parties that are actually trying to participate.
So this whole class of industries who manage – the way I think about this is there's a whole class of industries that insert themselves to reduce friction. So there's some friction about knowing what events are coming to a venue in your town, or if you care about an act, when will that act come to a venue in my town?
Right.
So maybe you don't know the venues, or you have to go on the act's website to find what venues they're at, and you've never been to that venue and you'll never go again. So there's some friction for a venue to get people to come to it, or to get acts to come to the venue. And a system like Ticketmaster, or somebody who or a company that wants to reduce friction says, oh, I have a solution. I will work with ACTS, I'll work with you, and I will provide a portal through which people know they can come to me and see what ACTS are available.
Well, it seems like, though, that that benefit of reducing friction is useful to people. Like, people like it. I mean, I use Fandango. I mean, assuming that what you're saying is assuming that there was a protocol in place that was easy to use for people to use the blockchain methodology, there doesn't have to be a federated owner. Everybody can agree upon the protocol, and therefore that middleman doesn't need to be there, but the frictionless quality still exists. That's the idea, right?
Right. So you could just put a website similar to the CryptoKitties. You could just put a website that that creates a visualization of the state of the database.
Yeah.
And anybody could go to it and then just see what acts have registered to play at what venues or what acts are available at venues near you. So you can recreate, you basically take the database that Ticketmaster has and crack it open and put it out there in the public.
Why is that compelling to you? Why is that exciting to you?
It's exciting to me because it's an evolution of how we use the internet. So we have a lot of companies that realized the power of gathering up sort of this dispersed information and providing a central place for people to access it.
Google, Facebook, Twitter, Ticketmaster.
I'm not the right person to bring those things up to.
Okay,
so
sure.
I don't like those things either.
Okay. But,
So let's go to Facebook. So Facebook essentially puts a front end and, for all intents and purposes, owns your social connections, your digital social connections. So people you used to work with, people you don't live near anymore.
And they did that because they produced an interface that was frictionless.
Yeah. So they produced an interface that was frictionless on top of data that was just sort of distributed but already existed out in the world. I mean, bands make contracts with venues with or without Ticketmaster. Ticketmaster just sort of picks up that data, and their business is provide a frictionless interface to customers to get.
And I might want to show you pictures of my cat, and I could do that with you. But going online to do that would require a lot of complexity. Comes Facebook, easy to do, frictionless, same kind of thing.
Yeah. So I actually discovered this firsthand when my son was born. How do I share pictures without using Facebook? And I really had to search hard for a solution to do that, to just be able to broadcast pictures of my son to family members who care. So there's something really powerful about stripping away the company or the sort of separate incentives and interests out of the system. Like, we figured out now that there's lots of data distributed all over the place. If you can just find a way to network it together or bind it together in a database, whether that's distributed or not, put a front end on it. People know how to use the internet now. They know how to use websites and search for things. And so we don't need a company to provide this service, especially when that company now has a self-interest in continuing to exist and to capture our attention or to retain relationships or prevent other people from capitalizing on those relationships. And it really gets us back to owning our own connections and our own data and really everything about the interactions that we want to have with companies that don't need to be centralized in something like a Facebook or like a Ticketmaster.
Okay, cool. I can see why you're excited by the use of this type of technology for other purposes. Are you seeing that kind of stuff emerge? Are you seeing uses of blockchain that are the removal of these middlemen?
Yeah. So a lot of these projects are in their infancy. Frankly, the technology is in its infancy. Some of the other exciting and kind of compelling cases are things like medical records, things that are or credit scores. That's kind of my pet. The one that I really want to see.
You can completely do credit scores this way, right?
Yeah. So the one that I really want to see is credit scores, but also medical records is another good one. I mean, this is data about you. I mean, this is your behavior or things that that are important to you that should be portable to you to go to any doctor you choose, or if you want to take out a loan, you should be able to present some proof of how creditworthy you are directly to the person from whom you want to borrow money. And instead, we have some vested interest in making sure those things are not portable. So the fact that it's only relatively recent that medical records are being digitized so that they can be sent without the use of a fax machine when the staff gets around to it is sort of mind-blowing to me in the digital age.
Yeah.
The fact that your credit score, one, is tied to a number given to you at birth that you can't change, and that the company that stores it and puts it at risk, Equifax, it makes money off of it. Yeah. They make money off of your behavior and then are a gatekeeper to your future behavior. And these are the kinds of things that I think had a time and will continue to be good for some people. I mean, there are people who don't want to think about it, don't want to worry about it. They're fine if Equifax or TransUnion makes money off of them because it makes their lives easier. But for people who want to have that control over their information or want to inspect it at will, they should be free to do so. And we now have a technological alternative that we can prove has all the integrity of the old system.
Mm-hmm. In fact, we can prove it better because it doesn't rely on secrecy.
Right. It doesn't, and when it doesn't rely on, you know, there was at least one hack of the Equifax's website for, you know, the credit freeze mm-hmm. thing, you know, in the backlash or in the aftermath of the big hack. So, I mean, these systems, we're putting a lot of trust into these companies to do security. Another example of this would be, you know, baby monitors and refrigerators are what brought down DNS, you know, last year, because there's no incentive to do security right. There is incentive to advertise you have a smart refrigerator.
Right.
Equifax has a lot of incentive to get your credit score right because the people who buy the data are the people who lend you money, not the people who generate the data that
us.
Equifax holds.
Right. Okay, I see.
So this is what I'm talking about, the misalignment of incentives.
Right.
They have no incentive to secure our data. They only have incentive to
make sure it's true.
Yeah, make sure it's true and keep their customers happy.
Yeah.
Actually, not even true, right? Because people have problems sort of reporting.
Not necessarily true, just reliable enough to sell it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I wanted to talk about the contract aspect of how Ethereum works, like how you can actually put a smart contract on. What's actually occurring there? Is there actually like a JavaScript bit of code or something?
Yeah, so they have a custom language. We're exhausting my technical knowledge, so I don't know what it compiles to, but they have essentially their own programming language that it would be familiar to people who write JavaScript. It's got some gotchas, which is, as I mentioned, there have been some problems where, mm-hmm. where people can exploit some facets of these contracts. But you submit this code to the network. Part of the agreement for running an Ethereum node is that you store this code and we'll execute it. If a transaction comes through that says,
I want to use that code.
Yeah, execute this function, here are the inputs. And there's a cost associated with it. So they've built in sort of a pricing model for running code, so the nodes that run the code charge a fee essentially for how intensive it is to run those programs, and then the result gets added to the blockchain also. So sometimes it's I want to transfer some tokens to Lyle, non Ethereum tokens, just, you know, Kyle tokens. I'll have a contract that takes as input my authorization and the amount and your Ethereum address, and then it has some internal state about how many of these tokens I have, and it will just transfer them to your address. But there's some code that has to happen and some data storage, and that's what running a node means, is that you
running
agree
an Ethereum
to do those
node.
Things. Yeah.
Okay. So when you in Bitcoin, when you run a node, if you will, if you run something, what you're doing is you're mining. You're just trying to find these puzzle pieces effectively
and validating
every transaction, yeah. And also find puzzle pieces, and you get paid based off of the puzzle pieces,
right.
Closing the envelope. In Ethereum world, the incentives are somehow different. But in general, when you're running a node, you're not just doing the mining aspect, looking for magical numbers. You're also saying, if somebody wants to run transactions through me, I can execute transactions and prove that I've done it by the methodology that's in the protocol.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's basically correct.
So there's not software running on the blockchain. There's software that's part of the contract that defines this blockchain. And that contract includes execution of other things as well.
Yeah. So the blockchain is...
It's the database still.
It's right? The database still. So there's a kind of nifty thing that that C# or .NET did a long time ago, where you could convert abstract syntax trees or expression trees into data and send it over the network, and it could be compiled and run at the other end.
Mm-hmm.
But it would just be represented as data sort of in transit. And smart contracts are like that. It's serialized code that is in the blockchain, and nodes have a full history of the blockchain. So when you refer to a contract by ID, they can go find that data and run it.
So the blockchain kind of becomes like a computer file system with bits of code that can be added to it.
Yeah, that's correct.
So it's like if I want to submit a smart contract, I'm kind of like adding a DLL that can be called at any time later on.
Exactly.
Okay. And so the protocol just has a lot more meat to it about executing code.
It has it has more meat to it about not just executing. It's added stuff over Bitcoin and okay. has added some. There are things that were discovered after Bitcoin was created that seemed useful. So, for example, a lot of these projects, the software is all open source, kind of in the spirit of this is a trustless system. So to really not trust, to really be able to inspect what's running on your computer, you should be able to download it from GitHub and it should work exactly, out of the box. So you can inspect all the code and make sure it's not doing anything weird or, cheating you. So what has happened in the last few years is that people fork the repos because they don't like the rules of the protocol. So they want to modify the rules in this way or that. And in fact, the current thing that people are calling Bitcoin was one of these things. This is sort of a long-running...
Right. There's Bitcoin Original or Bitcoin Classic.
Cash is what it's called. So that basically took the existing code base and forked it to go back to the original set of rules about the size of the data of the data blocks and I think the time. I think they made some adjustments in difficulty. Again, I actually don't get into the weeds too much on the specifics of each of these blockchains because it's very fickle.
There's thousands of them now. Thousands of them, right? Yeah. They're just exploding like kittens.
Yeah, like crypto kittens. So there's to me, that part is not as interesting unless you're going to actually do development against that blockchain. Then it's important to know the rules.
So one of the things that's interesting about the Ethereum methodology is because mm-hmm. there's these smart contracts, you can spawn up new currencies or new blockchains, you can start new blockchains off of Ethereum.
So you are participating in the Ethereum blockchain. So what I described about me giving you Kyle coins is an example of this. So it became such a common pattern for people to use the Ethereum blockchain to create their own tokens or their own coins by keeping some internal state in the contract where there's just an internal map of addresses to balance of Kyle coins or Lyle coins or Michael coins or whatever, that somebody standardized it and came up with a standard called the ERC-20 token standard. So it defines an interface for what one of these contracts has to look like or should look like so that it will respond reliably to various messages. It sort of just defines an API so that we can all write our own DLL that will mint or transfer or whatever, convert Ethereum to our coins. And so we'll define an exchange rate or some policies around it. And then this is where as I mentioned, a lot of these projects are in their infancy. A lot of how they do fundraising is through this, where they will create an Ethereum contract and say, you are contributing Ether to this contract, and then we'll give you some number of tokens for our project, and then that will have some meaning at a later date.
Ether is the coin of Ethereum, network, a blockchain.
Yes.
Okay. So let's say you and I decide to quit our very wonderful jobs at Netflix.
It was a terrible idea.
Yeah, we're not going to do that. And we wanted to supplant, because the good of humanity, supplant Ticketmaster and make micropayments for venues just work really easily. Mm-hmm. We could take one of these existing coins that somebody else has already developed. It's probably open source with a license that's kind enough where we could probably just grab it, make a copy of it, make some modifications to it, think, yeah, that's pretty good. Mm-hmm. And then we could invest. We could go ahead and say, hey, we're starting this new thing that's going to get rid of Ticketmaster. And I don't know what the incentive for people would be, but maybe venues. It's incentive for venues to do this because they can get rid of Ticketmaster fees. And so they would theoretically buy some Ethereum coin somehow, use transfer US cash or whatever currency to get some Ethereum, then take the Ethereum and send it to our contract. And from that, we would then send them some of this new Ticketmaster coins so they could be a part of it.
Yes.
That's the general thing?
Yeah. And so there's two...
And then we'd be broke and we have to sell our houses.
Right.
Okay.
Or we sell all the Ethereum that they or Ether that they sent us.
Oh, because potentially we could make a lot of money off of this big promise.
Right. So this is, to me, one of the it's unfortunate. I feel a little bit cynical about this particular topic. So this mechanism that you described is the jargon term is ICO, or initial coin offering, where people come up with a company idea, and rather than pitch it to investors, because that's hard and you have to convince them to give you money, you just put together a slick website promising something like, we're going to supplant Ticketmaster, and if you want to come along for the ride, send us Ether, and you will get Ticketmaster Slayer coins. And then at some later time, you can redeem them for prizes or free tickets.
Free tickets or
swag. It's basically like the Wild West days of Kickstarter
to me. It sounds like Kickstarter in a lot of ways. Yeah, so, or it sounds like the dot-com era, where it's like, hey, look, I've got ability to share pictures on the internet. And then, boom, you get $1 million.
Yeah, but we're the ones getting the $1 million. They're the ones getting the worthless stock or the sweatshirt or, you know, whatever people would give on Kickstarter. So to me, it's like Kickstarter because we actually have no obligation to them.
To do anything.
Except to give them these tokens. We can state, you know, all over the place, these tokens have no value. They'll have nothing to do in the future. Some of these projects are skirting... the law, really, because they're actually more like securities, because you can, some of them promise dividends. So last year, when I first noticed this phenomenon, there were several of these projects that said, oh yeah, and by the way, you'll get cash flow from this. Anybody who uses our product, you'll get some cut of the fees based on the tokens you have. And oh, by the way, if you're a US citizen, you can't participate because the SEC wants to treat this like a security. And then you say, oh, yeah, sure, wink, wink, go on a VPN and participate anyway.
Meaning, look like you're coming out of the country, not in the U.S., yeah.
Yeah. So,
and that's where you're talking about skirting the law.
Yeah, so that's the skirting the law. So it's like Kickstarter in that I'm just collecting money on a promise, and maybe I'll deliver, and maybe I won't, and maybe I'll promise you stuff, and maybe I won't. So it's very Wild West, and while some of the ideas, the pitches are really good, so like the medical record thing is a great idea, but they haven't delivered yet. I mean, again, this technology is in its infancy. Now, there's two ways this can go. So the CryptoKitties thing, that was an application that was actually developed on the Ethereum blockchain and is Ethereum native. So all the transactions take place on the blockchain. You could go look and find out what kitties everybody has. But a lot of these projects that do ICOs say that they're going to do what you said, which is basically create their own blockchain, either fork a code base or write a new one to... solve the problem that they're talking about, and then at some point they will exchange your ERC-20 spec token for their whatever coin.
Some of these, some of them you actually you have to register your token at some point. You have to do something so that they can then transfer things to you, theoretically. Right?
Yeah, so there's one project specifically that does this model called EOS, and if you want to think of... if you want to think of Ethereum like a file system, EOS wants to be an operating system. So it will even allow you to grab CPU time or RAM or, you know, storage, a bunch of stuff.
Again, using the amount of coin you have in that system for the amount of RAM you can have access to in the network.
Okay. Yeah, exactly. So they're doing something, as you referred to, where you buy this ERC-20 token, you send Ether to their contract, they issue you this token, and then you register your Ethereum key with them so that at a later date they can credit you a number of tokens on their network. Not all of them do this registration thing. That's started to become more common. It used to just be...
Trust.
Trust us. You know? Again, it's all sort of evolving.
So when you look at some of these markets, and it seems to be exploding, a lot of interest has happened. There was tons of PR about this in December because all the currencies seem to shoot up really high, and they fall and spike. It's kind of like it's a separate stock market in some ways. There's a whole bunch of little companies being spun up. This seems like a space you kind of want. My initial reaction is just to avoid it at all costs. But the stuff you're talking about of like, what interesting things could emerge because of this technology seems pretty – makes a lot of sense. And it seems like some of these little companies that are being startup, these initial coin offerings, are going to be those things. Like there might be a Ticketmaster Slayer right now that could do a really good job. And potentially they could set it up such that anybody that owns part of their coin gets some revenue from it or something.
They could. Again, there's so many legal issues. And governments are taking notice of this. So in addition to the U.S., I think Singapore is another one where they don't like this idea of kind of basically unregulated securities mm-hmm. Being sold to people. China makes the news seemingly every other week because their stance seems to change on how they want to deal with this.
And when the stance changes, the cryptocurrencies fall and rise?
Yeah, because there's one that is one of the areas that has subsidized power. And so Bitcoin in particular, does a huge amount of the mining power is actually consolidated in China, both because they have hardware manufacturing and subsidized power and lots of hydroelectric dams.
It's kind of amazing that we have this massive distributed system that's using tons of power, which collectively is mathematically agreeing on things. And there's something kind of, just from that perspective, kind of eloquent about it, in the sense that humanity coming together to do something. Of course, it's fed very much by greed.
Yeah, well, you're right. And to my eye, this is why I feel so torn about the ICO space. As you mentioned, there may be a Ticketmaster Slayer or an Equifax Slayer kind of in the works, but they would get lost in the noise of everyone else who's just a con artist, or maybe a well-meaning not con artist that turns into a con artist, or they're running a Ponzi scheme, or it's so easy, especially in December when there was this, as you mentioned, a huge run-up sort of across the board of cryptocurrencies. People just get dollar signs in their eyes, and so people want to get on board. Everything that sounds like it could be a good idea, you just put on a web page, we're disrupting a $200 billion industry, climb on the train. And here are instructions for how to use a VPN to pretend you're coming from a country that allows it. You know, it's so easy because we're in a space that, as you said, it's sort of using math to agree on things. It's distributed. It doesn't go through any traditional channels. So lots of people have spun up their own exchanges, I mean, like stock exchanges or currency exchanges, that are outside the bounds of sort of normal institutions. Kind of famously, there were many, many projects that would try and do arbitrage. And in fact, I wrote a program that did this, that would look for arbitrage opportunities across these exchanges because it's not really plugged in to the traditional systems that we have.
Right.
So it's easy to...
We've already created arbitrage systems that exist right now, and that's when we talk about the market's not really run by humans, it's run by computers. Mm-hmm. That's kind of what we're talking about, is systems making really smart decisions quickly. And in a new space like this, there's obviously opportunity to create those systems.
Right. Yeah. So we're really in the Wild West. So, I mean, these things just are so far apart from all of the safeties and safety nets and safety checks and... sort of normalizing functions that we have everywhere else, because one, it's global. I mean, that's sort of a double-edged sword. The fact that this currency is just a whatever you have is just a note in a database, and that database is global. So you have participants in all time zones. So it's like a 24/7 endeavor to be trying to either play the market or come up with ideas and, you know, put up websites and teams. Frequently advertise the fact that they're international because everyone can collaborate on this. So it's like all the good parts about frictionless cross-border communication and transfer of information. And there's like you said, even better security properties than a lot of the traditional systems that we have. But then on the other side of that, con artists take your money and you have no recourse.
Right. There's no government to go to.
Yeah. And anyone you go to might tell you, well, wait, why were you playing in that space? I mean, like, suddenly you're worse than, you're not just a victim with no recourse.
Yeah.
You may be a criminal.
Of course, the early stages of a place like this, there's a lot of opportunity.
Yes.
Right? I mean, even though there's a lot of opportunity for theft and con artists, mm-hmm. there's also other opportunities as well to get involved in the Ticketmaster Slayer project, right?
Like,
there is other things. One of the things you touched upon when chatting with me before was this idea that there's this inherent risk that the blockchain you're participating in, the current branch of the blockchain you're participating in, could be switched to another blockchain. There's this idea that you have to have global knowledge for this to actually work really well. And once you have bifurcation, you potentially lose truth.
Yes. So that was we touched on it during the main part of the show, which is there can be a case where I'm some third party and I get two selfies and they just have different histories back to some point, and then they sort of reconverge
right,
on a shared history. That's essentially that's what we're talking about. And the protocol defines how I decide which one is true.
But that decision can be made again at any time.
Yeah. So the analogy that I use when I describe this to people is there could be, by the rules, some alien civilization or some part of the network that is not broadcasting anything, but is just accepting everything. And unbeknownst to everyone else, they have this massive pool of compute resources. And so they're 1,000 blocks ahead of everyone else. And then once they publish to everyone, your node will automatically just throw away everything that you did up until that point.
Because there's new history that's better.
Yeah.
And that's any length of the chain.
Yes.
It becomes progressively more difficult to do that, but...
Yeah, so this is something we didn't touch on, but there are quite a few conventions that have popped up on the number of confirmations or nested pictures that you need to have before you have a very improbable event that history is going to be countermanded. Excuse me. And for most financial transactions on Bitcoin, that's 6 confirmations. So 5 blocks built on the mm-hmm. block that contains your transaction. But again, these are sort of heuristic. I mean, we just right. haven't seen a case where, for example, and this has come up many times, let's say that China, for some reason, decides to turn on the Great Firewall on the ports that do Bitcoin traffic. Suddenly, a huge chunk of the network has gone dark and a huge chunk of the mining power has gone dark. And once that network partition resolves,
when
it opens back up again, if it opens back up again, suddenly there should be a panic. What is going to happen when we try and reconcile these blockchains about activity that took place behind the firewall and then on our side?
You could imagine if that happened with that wall, you would imagine that anybody outside of China wouldn't win because there's most mining power exists in China.
Well, but they would only be competing amongst themselves, right? So they may collude at that point. I mean, there would be every reason for the big mining firms mm-hmm. to collude at that point so that they could mint all the blocks. So there are scenarios kind of at the boundaries of once you sort of get back to, down from the sort of the abstract and get back to the real world, and there are really governments that care about this sort of thing and think about what the ramifications would be if one of these crazy events happened, if there was some government interference. Regardless of what you think about that, just the fact that they could do this, or the U.S. or the FCC could allow Comcast to just kill that traffic, and so now the U.S. goes dark in terms of the blockchain.
Right.
So all of your Bitcoin, you'd have to travel outside the country to even submit a transaction to the network, and you may find that when you get there, the state of the world is totally different. Or, your transactions never made it, out there, so you never got paid. These are going to be real concerns for people. And part of why I think it's a little bit crazy, like the upside of a portable international currency is that it goes with you. But the bad side is that you could become the victim of any particular government's idiosyncrasies around mm-hmm. the technology.
Yeah, okay. Interesting. All right. Is there anything?
Sorry. You mentioned that there was a... There was something you said. I want to pop the stack a little bit. You said that going all in on one blockchain is a little bit risky because this history can change. But I interpreted that ambiguously, and the other way is also dangerous. Which for you, if you've invested a lot of money in this, is as I mentioned, there was at one point a very close race between Bitcoin and Bitcoin Cash or Bitcoin Classic, where it was imminent that it would become more profitable to mine the other blockchain than Bitcoin. And if that happened, we don't know what would happen to the value of Bitcoin. Because, again, you may reach a situation where it's not valuable for it to keep mining blocks for Bitcoin. And so the global consensus around which token is actually more valuable to have may switch.
Mm-hmm.
Right away, because network throughput would drop to almost zero on Bitcoin.
And no exchanges could take place, effectively.
Right, and you couldn't move your currency to an exchange because nobody would confirm the transactions, and you couldn't move your tokens off the exchange. Maybe the exchange would realize that they're now holding a bag of kind of useless tokens, or rather totally illiquid tokens.
Mm-hmm.
So they may shut down trading. I mean, this happened on one of the exchanges that does U.S. dollars to Bitcoin Cash. They had such a massive influx of requests for trading that the spread was like $9,000 or something between the lowest ask and the highest bid, because they couldn't process transactions fast enough. And so nobody knew what was going to happen when they reactivated trading. Would the order book actually try and resolve that conflict, or nobody knows. So we have all these boundary conditions where they're unexplored.
Yeah.
In theory, this all works and we get a better society with lower friction and peer-to-peer goodness for all sorts of systems, and there would be real alternatives to Ticketmaster and Equifax and Facebook. But in practice, we haven't actually exercised any of that.
Yeah.
So we don't know. And again, this is part of why I think it's crazy for people to invest too much money, specifically money, into any particular technology.
So what about right now? So one of the libertarian concepts about this that's so compelling, it's kind of like, I got my gold. I don't have to have a government involved. This has value. I can trade it. Bitcoin feels that same way in the sense that no one knows how much I've got, and I can trade it whenever I want, and no one has to know who I am when I'm doing it. There's this very liquidated quality about it, very much mm-hmm. ownership quality, but it's really compelling to that same mindset. However, right now, when I make a transaction to buy tickets at Ticketmaster,
yep.
I use my Visa card, and Visa company has all this compute power dedicated to making sure that transaction goes smoothly, and they even have safeguards in place that if I feel like I didn't get the service I wanted, I can actually get reimbursed by that company. Like there's a lot of legal and patterns that take place that benefit me as a customer. Mm-hmm. Of course, we're also spending 35 cents per transaction, which they're making some money.
Yeah, you pay for it.
Yeah. But in that situation, it's the coin, the currency, the cryptocurrency seems compelling in the sense there's not that middle person. But there are these, in Bitcoin, for example, there are these miners that have an immense amount of power. The people that actually control the minting of coin or the closing the envelopes have a lot of power in the system, don't they? I mean, is it really different than Visa?
That's a great question. So there are opinions on both sides of this question. So there is a additional fee that is optional that you may offer any particular miner to include your transaction in a block. So there's a large pool of transactions that are pending confirmation, meaning they have not been stuffed into any envelopes yet. And the miners are allowed to collect fees that are offered as part of those transactions. So obviously, they will include all of the transactions in the envelope that they're working on that offer the highest fees. So when the network gets congested and there are many, many, many more transactions in the pool per minute or per 10 minutes than can possibly be included in an envelope per 10 minutes, the fees tend to go up.
Mm-hmm.
This happens with Ethereum also. Ethereum has the same problem. In fact, any system that does proof of work and needs to have a way to prioritize should include a mechanism like this. I've heard an argument that that is bad because it makes it less like a currency and more like a credit card with way lower throughput. And I've also heard the argument that it's good because it shows that that coin is valuable to move. And if it's valuable to move, then it's valuable to have. So,
and the fees are, theoretically, it gets the fee structure gets created by the amount of work that's being done. Like it's kind of inherent in the system. It's an automatic system. Or I get to choose how much fee I want to use.
You choose how much fee you want to offer. Mm-hmm. And so if your transaction could be confirmed any old time, you don't care. You might not offer any fee. And it'll just sort of always be at the bottom of the heap. And it may never actually get confirmed.
Hmm.
So you create a marketplace. It's sort of similar to, again, to use the stock market or currency exchange market analogy. The miners are the ones that are picking up the transactions, and other folks are basically offering up their transactions with a little prize attached if they'll be included. So some systems, so wallets essentially will by default offer a good fee, or they'll poll the network and see what the fees were on the last two blocks worth of transactions to get an estimate. I mean, so there's some adaptive systems in place that try to do some automatic pricing, but the crux of the issue is exactly what you said, that when there is more demand than there is throughput, the fees are going to go up, and that is analogous to something like a credit card, a lot only worse because the credit card will always accept or reject within a very short time frame, and then there's some reconciliation process sort of after the fact. You know, maybe you have a bill outstanding and they had some fees, or you have to sort of do remediation with the vendor, whatever. But they've made the user experience very smooth, sort of regardless of those contingencies. Whereas Bitcoin is sort of like paying at the register to have your credit card run.
Right.
Where you basically, you're in line to buy your product, and then you're in the line to get your credit card run through the one very slow credit card machine. And you can offer the person running credit cards, like, yeah, here's like 10 bucks. Would you let me sort of at the front of the line? So you've created sort of a secondary market for that.
Yeah.
That's another problem that is trying to be solved. There are several, they're called second layer solutions that are in the works, as well as scalability solutions that are on-chain. So on-chain means either modifying the protocol or modifying the software that interprets the data to make this faster and increase throughput. Second layer solutions are an attempt to be similarly secure, but handle a lot of the transactional or sort of rapid exchange or back and forth of information, and then only commit once, sort of batches of transactions. So there's this idea, it's called the Lightning Network for Bitcoin. This is a second layer solution where you basically open up payment channels and create equivalent obligations at either end of the channel. And then when transactions get submitted, you basically subtract from one end or the other. And then after a allotted amount of time, you commit both. And now you have mathematically compensated everybody.
Right. Okay. I see what you're saying.
But you've managed to batch it up.
This can be done for exchanges that are doing lots of transactions.
Yeah, or I mean, think Starbucks. Yeah. So if you want to run one of these nodes, you open up basically a line of credit with Starbucks of, you know, $100,000, and then people run through you very, very quickly. You know, I want to pay $4, I want to pay $3, I want to pay $1.50 to Starbucks. And the $100,000 at Starbucks's end that they're going to give to you just decrements by those amounts. So you're accumulating people's money, and then at the end, you're going to send $100,000 to Starbucks, and then the balance of what people have committed to send to Starbucks, Starbucks will send back to you. So if people in a day spend $40,000, I send Starbucks $100,000, they send me $60,000, and everyone's compensated.
Yeah, this is kind of how banks do move money as well, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Take two steps back. The thing about this technology being in its infancy, and as you said, we have lots of systems in the world today that do this using central authorities like banks or like credit card companies. So trying to reinvent the user experience in the decentralized, trustless world is kind of where we're at. We're trying to find the rough edges or the sharp edges and figure out how to put padding on them or maybe get rid of them completely in some cases. So, you know, Ticketmaster convenience fees of being $15 for every ticket, maybe you can make it a marketplace for if I really want to get the best seats, maybe I'll offer more to get, you know, at the front of the line.
So what do you think the next big interesting thing that's going to happen in the crypto area?
The move from proof of work to proof of stake.
Okay,
so that's
gonna be
one of the key things that is acting as a bottleneck for throughput.
Are any of these in ICOs and initial coin offerings trying to solve that problem?
The EOS is trying to solve that problem. So they have a protocol for proof of stake that that they're very confident in. And then there are a couple of other projects.
Who are the people behind that coin? Like, is it just, how do you know who it is?
So they have a website. It's a company called Block One. I think they're based out of the Cayman Islands or something. I mean,
why do you have trust that it's not some scam?
Why do I have trust?
You know what I mean? Like, I've heard the name too. I've heard EOS many times for some reason, but.
For some reason.
Meaning that, like, the people that I know are talking about it? Yeah.
Yeah. So there is a guy associated with that project who has already gotten kind of famous in the space. His name is Dan Larimer. He has a couple of very successful projects, blockchain projects with their own blockchains.
That weren't scams.
Meaning.
Or haven't been yet.
Yeah, so one of them is actually a cryptocurrency exchange called BitShares, and another one is called Steemit, which is a social media-based blockchain.
Steem, yeah, I heard of that.
Yeah, that's actually, that one's very cool. So that does not, that actually uses something like proof of stake, where upvotes essentially will give you the currency. So currency gets created every block, which has a fixed time based on inputs from users.
So like imagine it's like it's a blogging system, kind of like a social networking system, but blog system. So I post a blog, a whole bunch of other people that are participating in the system upvote that entry, they like it a lot, and therefore then I have currency in the system to do things like promote more of my blog or whatever.
Yeah, promote more of your blog or promote other people's things. Your upvotes become more valuable than other upvotes. Yeah, so it's
social currency
like
system.
Yeah, so
cool.
Yeah, so this guy Dan has a lot of clout in the community because he's created two very different blockchain projects already, and is now associated with this EOS project.
And that's one of the reasons why people have some trust.
That's one of the reasons that they're also meeting all their milestones. So they have delivered a testnet as they said they would. They have delivered some alpha and beta versions of the software. It's all on GitHub.
So they're not really launched yet.
Correct. So their production system could go online as early as June 1st of this year.
Are they using the Ethereum thing where they have a contract and you put money in the contract and then you get some idea of future ownership of the system?
Yeah, so this was very clever, in my opinion, that it wasn't just like a fixed fundraising window. It's that they basically encourage cost averaging into this. So their fundraising period was over a year, and every day what they would do is accumulate Ether into the contract, and then there was a fixed number of tokens that would be generated every day.
Ether tokens or this new token?
This new token. And then that number of tokens was divided by the amount of Ether, and then you got proportionally to what you committed for that day in their tokens. And they do that every day. So it behooves you, because you don't know when is going to be a light contribution day where you get a better return, and what's going to be a heavy contribution day, because everybody is just sort of sending Ether to this contract.
But couldn't you, I mean, all that Ether that's being sent to that contract is public inherently from the blockchain, yep. It's public. So couldn't you just look at it over the day and go, oh, today's a light day, I'm going to put more in?
Sure, you can do
that. But that's an arbitraging system. Other people are thinking of it, and therefore you're in conflict.
Yeah, you can do that. There might be a website that tracks this sort of thing.
Right, I see. Okay. So the general idea of this, though, at some point they will... because they're actually not just doing a fundraiser on something, they're actually creating a new
blockchain. Yeah.
So that blockchain doesn't exist yet, or the tokens,
testnet does.
And that's what they're sending you is these entries or not?
No. So this is actually a common pattern for testnets. They'll have what's called a faucet, but basically some contract that they have just put that's sort of dumb, except that it will give you currency on the testnet so that you can play with stuff. So for things like Ethereum or EOS, because they charge you for resources on the network, to run contracts or whatever, if you want to test stuff, you need currency. But there's no way to get currency because it's not live. And so, you can't take payments for things. So they just have sort of static, dumb faucet contracts that'll give you some currency.
Okay,
so,
I see.
So that's how people are playing around on the testnet.
Meaning like using their API, because it's a system where you can ask for resources and things, like doing all that kind of development thing.
And on the Ethereum testnet, there's a similar kind of thing where you can just like get a bunch of money so that you can write a contract and then run your test cases against it. But to run test cases, you have to submit transactions, and so you need test network money.
Makes
so it's
sense.
A test database versus production database.
Similar to what we do at Netflix here, right? We have a test system for making sure that we don't mess up before we give it to people.
Yeah, and sometimes we'll make those movies available in the test environment before the production environment. It's the same kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah. And for these things that are done that way, a lot of it is trust-based though, right? I mean, it's got to be at some level.
Oh, totally. So as I sort of cynically put it earlier, if you just put together a slick website, you can probably dupe some people into giving you Ether. And this is kind of the Wild West aspect that I don't want to say is calmed down, but people have been burned enough, or it's out on Twitter that so-and-so is a scam artist, or don't contribute to this because, it's garbage. We traced it back to whatever, some...
Again, global knowledge is very helpful in the situation, right?
Yeah. So you can see, who that person is, or at least what their transaction history is. Oh, they immediately took your Ether and cashed it out. So, stop. Don't send any more money. So some of these companies will make public who their team is. So some of the better known blockchain projects have people that either have a history in the space.
Like Daniel.
Like Daniel. Or... they have some connections to academia, and then you can go check with those people in their departments at their university. To make more information about themselves public. And again, this is sort of a discovery process. We're discovering what people can do. So there are con artists, and they may or may not get found out. And there's always, you know, there's a sucker born every minute. So they will always be able to sort of siphon money out of people. But the more sophisticated projects are realizing, you know, it's more than just polish on the web page. We got to talk about our team. We got to have deliverables. We got to have roadmaps. People need to be able to hold us accountable because we're asking them to send us money on a promise.
Similar to better Kickstarter projects, right?
I mean.
Okay, so one last question, and that is that if Bitcoin has these energy fail potentials and also doesn't really produce other things, it seems like Ethereum has this benefit of having a system which produces startups or allows you to produce startups. Bitcoin doesn't have that ability. But Ethereum has all the abilities that Bitcoin does have. Why is it that Bitcoin is still the dominant player? Why hasn't something like Ethereum become the primary cryptocurrency?
I have no idea. That's a great question. I don't know. So there are a couple things. It seems like there are a couple things driving that. One is momentum. The Bitcoin is the best known. So new people are more likely to gravitate towards it.
Can you recommend to someone that kind of knows the space, don't invest in Bitcoin?
I highly recommend nobody invest in Bitcoin. I'm not a financial advisor. I don't give financial advice.
That's actually a very common refrain
On YouTube videos because loads of people
have opinions.
Have opinions and they make YouTube videos, but they've all slowly adopted the same disclaimer of I'm not a financial advisor. This is my personal opinion. Nothing I say should be construed as financial advice, but you got to buy the dip because it's going to go to $1 million. You know, so it's so that kind of hysteria.
Sure.
It seems so, as you said, like, what are the reasons? Well, everybody's heard of it.
Yeah.
But how far does that take you? How long until everybody's heard of another thing?
Yeah.
There's a lot of sunk cost. There is a concrete reason. There's a huge misalignment of incentives between miners and the community. So the fact that there are large farms of hardware that just mine Bitcoin. And these are specifically specific circuits. So they're called ASICs or application specific integrated circuits that are just designed to do the hashing algorithm. That works on Bitcoin.
Hardware.
SHA-256 hardware.
Sure.
So it's the lowest power you can get for the best efficiency of generating these things. So there's a huge investment from the miners in keeping that part of the protocol as is. And they don't really care about the rest of it. So any innovation that involves changing the protocol will not get buy-in from the active nodes in the network, or at least the majority of active nodes in the network. There's also folks who have a lot of money invested in Bitcoin who don't want to see changes to the protocol that they think will damage the brand, so to speak.
Yeah.
There's the developer community that wants to increase throughput because there's this tension between it's a valuable thing, so it should be hard to move, but not so hard that nobody uses it, because if nobody uses it, then it has no value. This is sort of a process of discovery and very organic how the price moves or doesn't move. And it's all, again, because we're sort of at the fringes where big institutions and institutional money or people who have already solved the problems in sort of the mainstream economy and markets with arbitrage and with coming up with rational pricing and, you know, things being backed by governments or GDP or, you know, whatever, like you can tie it to some activity in the real world. This is very divorced from that. So everyone's kind of refiguring out what the right price for things is. How valuable is this versus that? What's the utility of this token versus that token?
Yeah.
So I don't know why any particular coin is worth anything.
That's a great way to end it. Kyle Barr, thank you so much for doing this with me. That was really fun.
Hey, you're welcome.
Yeah, thanks. This is GeekSpeak. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence, who's used with permission. And GeekSpeak is Creative Commons Attribution 3.0. You can use their stuff any way you'd like. Just let them know we made it. My name's Lyle Troxell. I have been speaking today with Kyle Barr. Thank you so much
today. You're welcome.
For chatting with me. Was there anything else you want to say? Anything you want to push?
No. I've got nothing to push. I think this is incredibly interesting. And if you are the kind of person who can resist getting the dollar signs in your eyes, it's a very rich space to learn about.
Rich in the sense of growth and knowledge.
There's so much to learn. There's so much knowledge to gain. And you will be exposed to areas of knowledge you didn't even know existed.
Yeah, cool. All right, thanks, Kyle.